It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only.
I'm delighted to welcome Terry Prince into the studio again, and he's going to help us to understand one of Dickens' most interesting works, and we've just heard the beginnings of it there. It's a wonderful piece, isn't it?
Absolutely, and how relevant. I mean, it resonates today, does it not, in terms of the UK's relationship to France and Europe in general, the best of times, the worst of times. You know, some people will think it's the best of times, and some will think it's the worst of times.
Well, we better not go too far down that route. But we better not. Because we're talking about A Tale of Two Cities.
We are.
By the time Dickens wrote this one, he was well-established, he was quite well-known.
Absolutely, yeah. Lionised. Everybody knew Dickens. The working man read Dickens. And his novels, as you know, were serialised, so people were queuing up to buy the next edition of the story. And I think that's what makes this a particularly exciting read, because you've got sort of the cliffhanger notion. You want to keep reading on and following the story through. Yes, he was well established by now, not just as a writer. Around about now, I think it's 1859 or so, 1860, he began his career as a public reader, where he read extracts from his novels to huge gatherings all over the UK, and he toured America on a couple of occasions as well. In fact, Dickens, I think, was an actor manqué. And the story goes that had he not caught a cold on the day he was going to audition at a London theatre, he would have ended up as a professional actor. And his readings were tremendously theatrical readings. And I'm sure, and I know in fact, that Tale of Two Cities, extracts from those, featured in his readings.
Because it's about two countries, it's about England and France, at a very critical time, because we're leading up to the revolution in France and the concerns about the revolution in England. So we've got two sets of characters sets of situations.
We've got the two cities, the relatively peaceful and calm London, where Lucy Manette, and once she releases him from the Bastille, her father, Dr. Manet, live, and the banker. It's calm, it's peaceful, but the country is very aware of the revolution in France and the bloody aftermath of the revolution that's going on now. So you have this terrific contrast with the calm of London, contrasted with the violence and poverty, which produces more violence in a way. The people are very, very angry in Paris and the suburbs of Paris.
Hunger. It was prevalent everywhere. Hunger was pushed out of the tall houses and the wretched clothing that hung upon poles and lines. Hunger was patched into them with straw and rag and wood and paper. Hunger was repeated in every fragment of the small modicum of firewood that the man sawed off. Hunger stared down from the smokeless chimneys and started up from the filthy street that had no offal among its refuse of anything to eat. Hunger was the inscription on the baker's shelves, written in every small loaf of his scanty stock of bad bread, at the sausage shop, in every dead dog preparation that was offered for sale. Hunger rattled its dry bones among the roasting chestnuts in the turned cylinder.
And there are some particular characters that Dickens explored in Paris.
Madame Defarge, who's hell-bent on gaining her revenge on the aristocratic family that carried out atrocities against her predecessors. And the member of that family she's particularly after, of course, is connected with the aforementioned Lucy Manette. So you have the love story there, which is in danger of being destroyed by the actions of the bloodthirsty Madame Defarge, a woman to be feared.
I believe with all my soul that we shall see the triumph. But even if not, even if I knew certainly not, show me the neck of an aristocrat and tyrant, and still I would. Then Madame, with her teeth set, tied a very terrible knot indeed. Hold, cried Defarge, reddening a little as if he felt charged with cowardice. I too, my dear, will stop at nothing. Yes, but it is your weakness that you sometimes need to see your victim and your opportunity to sustain you. Sustain yourself without that, When the time comes, let loose a tiger and a devil, but wait for the time with the tiger and the devil chained, not shown, yet always ready.
I mentioned Madame Defarge. She's contrasted with Miss Pross, who is Lucy's confidant, etc. A terrifically powerful English lady. Think Margaret Rutherford. A nice comic relief as well, which is needed throughout the book. So you have the clash of these two women as one kind of storyline in the book.
Mrs. Pross is one of the characters, the typically Dickensian character in many ways, but there are others as well, and there's one that struck me.
Jerry Cruncher.
Mr. Cruncher reposed under a patchwork counterpane like a harlequin at home. At first, he slept heavily, but by degrees began to roll and surge in bed, until he rose above the surface with his spiky hair looking as if it must tear the sheets to ribbons, at which juncture he exclaimed in a voice of dire exasperation, "Bust me, if she ain't at it again!" A woman of orderly and industrious appearance rose from her knees in a corner with sufficient haste and trepidation to show that she was the person referred to. "What?" said Mr. Cruncher, looking out of bed for a boot. "You're at it again, are you?" After hailing the morn with this second salutation, he threw a boot at the woman as a third. It was a very muddy boot.
Very robust English character of the kind that Dickens was familiar with drawing.
So what Dickens is doing here is he's set himself in a historical context, yeah, which is not typical of many of the other Dickens books that we know so well. I mean, you think of Great Expectations, the political context is not really well declared.
Now, off the top of my head, I can't think of another one that
that's right. So I think this is quite different in that sense, and yet he maintains the ability to construct characters. Yeah. And so, as you said, it's in series. You see, you get a bite-sized chunk each week if you're buying the paper, as it were.
That's right.
And in there, you keep the entertainment level going through these characters sometimes. They're not trivial characters. They're real. They've got a role to play, and they have a significant role to play in all of them in many ways. Mm-hmm. But it's also the cliff-edge stuff and the characterization.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes it very entertaining.
Absolutely. His characters, I mean, even people who haven't read Dickens know of Dickensian characters. They know of Scrooge. They know of Oliver Twist.
Mr. Squeers.
They know Wackford Squeers. Yeah. Because they are so colourful. They're often accused of being larger than life with no kind of psychological depth. And I think there may well be some credence in that. But does it really matter in terms of the overall kind of shape of the story that he's telling? If you want psychological depth, you probably don't go to Dickens. But if you want well-drawn characters and a strong narrative, then you probably do go to Dickens.
Dickens is very difficult to read because it's quite dense,
yes,
and there are often sections that you think, crikey, I wish you'd get to the end of this and get back to the story. But of course, what he's doing is giving the colour and the context. And that's why listening to it is quite fun, because it takes you along with it. So you have the voice of the narrator to give you that extra access.
It's a narrator's joy, I think, to read a Dickens novel because you've got so many different characters to play with. I think your previous point is very well made, but I think the whole experience of reading then and now is very, very different. We live, I think, do we not, in an impatient age. We need to do something, get on to the next thing before we finish the first thing properly. So we have e-readers and we have smartphones to read from. And then life was slower paced, I would suggest, and you had time. I mean, what did you do in the evening if you didn't read? There wasn't a radio, there wasn't television, etc. And so he was able to indulge himself. I think that's a very fair
criticism. Wasn't also, as you said yourself earlier, he wasn't appealing to an elitist audience, because the common man could access.
There are many stories of common people breaking down in tears when they heard that Dickens had died. He was a friend to all of us. He was a man we could relate, and a man who related to us. Because he used to go on these midnight walks. He'd walk London, the streets of London, and because he had this actor's ability, had this actor's ear, he could put people on the page through their language alone. I mean, he's a master at doing this. Okay, so you don't get the psychological depth, perhaps, but you do get this string of colourful characters. So,
of course, Dickens knew his London very well. He'd had a pretty tough upbringing, hadn't he? I mean, he'd been in...
Very much so, yes.
His father's loss of money, he'd been in the debtor's prison while he did.
His father ended up in the Marshalsea, and in one of his novels, Little Dorrit, explores the Marshalsea there. But the worst experience he had, which he writes about on many occasions, is when he was sent to a blacking factory to work on the edge of the Thames in a blacking factory, and he thought thought he deserved far better than this. And what really upset him was his mother colluded in this act. And when he eventually was able to get away from there, she was off sending him back again. He had a very kind of rudimentary education, but he had above all an amazing energy. When you read anything about him, this is what impressed me more than anything else. The man was just a human dynamo. He never kind of stopped. I mean, he edited these monthly magazines. Before that, he was a journalist, churning stuff out. He was a law reporter. And then he became a novelist with his breakthrough novel, Pickwick Papers. And from then on, there was no looking back. It wasn't a wasted minute in his life. He was a man of tremendous energy. A man also who was the epitome of the English family man, the English hearth and all that kind of thing with the Christmas stories and what have you. Absolutely vile in his treatment of his wife.
Let's go back to The Tale of Two Cities, because that's where we came into this, although yes. The whole point is that there's so much in Dickens that anybody can explore and listening to it, if not reading. Lucy, you mentioned the young girl whose father has come out of imprisonment and in a very shocking state.
In the Bastille, yes.
Very awful. But she has two or three or four potential lovers, people that fall in love with her.
That's right.
A couple of young men and some characters
that are
highly unsatisfactory. Yeah. But the two young men, one is fairly straightforward. He may have come from Paris. He has a background, which we could talk about.
Charles Darnay has a background indeed, and it's the very background that involves him with, or gets Madame Defarge involved with him. It's an aristocratic background that he comes from, and he falls in love with Lucy, and the implications of that involve another man who, had he thought more highly of himself, would have considered himself a suitor to Lucy, and that's Sidney Carton. But as Sidney says of himself, I care for no man on earth and no man on earth cares for me. He's an outsider, a maverick, no kind of self-respect whatsoever, and yet he makes a moral journey throughout this book of an immense distance.
He's not seen that often in the story, is he?
No, because the main story is that about the machinations of Madame Defarge and the fellow revolutionaries to exact their revenge on anybody who's left from the aristocratic Evremont family. And of course, Lucy's father, unbeknownst to her, was imprisoned as a result of machinations by an aristocratic family to prevent him speaking the truth about an event that happened early on in his life. And he was thrown into the Bastille for that. So there's this constant intertwining of the two cities, London and Paris, through the characters involved. Lucy, Darnay, Carton, Defarge on the French side, etc. That this is a novel which moves at a great pace. He can be very, very wordy. This one rattles along, I think, anyway. I mean, he knocked it off in a year, which was some going, really. If you listen to this, I'm sure you'll be swept along because of the depth of feeling of the characters for each other and the sheer excitement of a tale and the fact that, you know, we all have a knowledge, no matter how deep, we all have a knowledge of the French Revolution and the atrocities that were carried out there.
The grindstone had a double handle, and turning at it madly were two men whose faces, as their long hair flapped back when the whirlings of the grindstone brought their faces up, were more horrible and cruel than the visages of the wildest savages in their most barbarous disguise. False eyebrows and false moustaches were stuck upon them, and their hideous countenances were all bloody and sweaty, and all awry with howling, and all staring and glaring with beastly excitement and want of sleep. As these ruffians turned and turned, their matted locks now flung forward over their eyes, now flung backward over their necks, some women held wine to their mouths that they might drink. And what with dropping blood, and what with dropping wine, and what with the stream of sparks struck out of the stone, all their wicked atmosphere seemed gore and fire. The eye could not detect one creature in the group free from the smear of blood.
That keeps you riveted to the story. So don't be put off by the fact that, oh, it's Dickens and it might be long-winded and go on forever. No, it rattles a lot.
Revolutions are bloodthirsty, so there's, you know, once the revolution's begun, the number of killings and attacks increases, and so it becomes very, very dangerous, and that comes into the essence of the story itself, of course, because our characters find themselves in the middle of that. One of the things that I remember you told me once was that you'd produced a version of this as a stage play. I can't imagine how that was done.
Well, we put it into one of our seasons at the Abbey Theatre, 10 years ago or so, I suppose. I forget the name of the dramatist who turned it into a play. I believe it had its first performance at Greenwich Theatre, and we got the rights, secured the rights to do it on stage. It's what I've just said. It's a great narrative, and it drives its way through, and that made it a very attractive proposition for me to direct and put it on stage. And also it had a range of characters. So you had the aristocracy, and it had the poor people of Paris, thirsty for revenge, as well as hungry for food. So a nice large cast, all the key characters were there.
You had your romantic storyline going through.
And you had the Sidney Carton storyline going through. And it was, will they be caught? Will they escape? Will true love find satisfaction? Or will the guillotine claim yet another victim? It was staged with a working guillotine. How can that be, I hear you cry? Did you have 24 actors for each character? Not at all. It was the most efficient thing I've ever seen. We got the idea from Greenwich. Our wonderful team of workmen constructed this thing. And all I can tell you is, sitting in the audience, you saw the victim put his head in the hole. You saw the guillotine axe above him. That roll of drums, the axe fell. And the head fell into the basket. Obviously not the real head. We couldn't afford that many actors, and we had no volunteers for those roles anyway. Every night that happened, there was a gasp from the audience. It was terrific. So it worked as a play, I think, because Dickens, for me, always has that element of a theatre man about him. He was a lover of theatre and, as I said before, could have been an actor himself, and in fact did set up his own little acting company, performed in various houses throughout the UK, including over at Nebworth. And I think there may even still be some Dickensian events at Nebworth. So it did adapt for the stage very well. Not the only Dickens we've done. We actually won the few amateur companies to have ever tackled Nicholas Nickleby that the RSC did in the 90s. In the 80s. And we did both parts of that.
Dickens has transferred to film many times very successfully. So there's obviously that inherent drama in everything he does. And I think probably that you've said a lot about Dickens and why it's great to read this. And I think all we would say is give it a go.
Give it a go. An exciting story. And, I mean, without the guillotine, I still think resonates today. And you'll all know the final sentence when you hear it.
It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Thank you. Thanks for asking me.